Chair, we'd like to begin. The topic is Hetzer Ishbal. A loan transaction with a fellow Jew, the person who makes this loan, desires to earn interest on a loan. This would be violate prohibition against Rivas Katsutsa on a deraisa level. And if a fellow Jew purchases an item from another Jew and desires to make payment by means of installment, and an interest premium is included in the installment payment, this is a very common type of transaction. And this is also prohibited, but on a rabbanim level, because it's derech mecha chomemka, making payment by means of some added charge for the delay in payment. This is avak ribis. So it is desirable, these two very common transactions, when one party that provides the capital, in one case, the lender, and the other case, the merchant, they desire to earn an extra premium because of the terms of the transaction. It is desirable to transform, to restructure the transaction so that there would be no ribis violation. So here we have a usable instrument called Hetzer Ishbal, which involves the restructuring of the transaction. So it has its origins in the 1550s, and as we will see, there are definite problems with the structure, elements of the structure, in reference to various modern transactions. But first let us discuss in its pristine form, the way it was first thought of, as a means of restructuring a loan transaction. Of course, the other one is just as important, the installment plan sale. What's involved is as follows, that Reuven will, in case of a loan, instead of regarding transfer of money as a loan, instead it will be regarded as simply a capital transfer to someone else for the purpose of setting up a partnership, shukis. And we have two members of the partnership. The person that provides the capital is called the financier. He's a silent partner, and he has no decision-making authority in the business, no managerial role in the business. That's why we call him a silent partner. And the person that's the recipient of the capital will be called the managing partner. So already there's a restructuring. We don't conceive it as a loan, but rather as the setting up of a partnership. Now, this type of relationship is discussed in the Gemara, and it's called an iska. And if someone gives someone capital, and just said, I'm giving it to you for the purpose of iska, and what relationship they're set up is that the financier is a silent partner, and there is giving money to someone who's called the managing partner. So without any stipulation of what the terms are, they were silent on the specific terms. The Gemara says, ha iska, palga milva palga, because it would be regarded as half loan, half deposit. Now, what distinguishes a loan from a deposit, from the yikadon, is responsibility in the event of unavoidable circumstances, onus. If someone borrows money, he is responsible to return the money regardless of what happens to the money. That is the basic element of a loan. So the loaner obligates himself to return the money regardless of what happens to the money. But if yikadon, person deposits trust, person that accepts it, he is a shomer. So there is certainly an exemption of onsim. If there's something, an unavoidable circumstance happened, he is certainly exempt. So, in terms of division of profits and losses, that portion of the capital that the recipient takes upon himself responsibility. In other words, let us say he is accepting 50% of the losses if they do occur. That automatically will characterize 50% of the transfer as a halvah, because that is the distinguishing feature of halvah, that the person who accepts it is a chayav ba'onsin. So even though he's giving him the money, the Taurus Iska, and there's no mention of a loan, and it would seem that we could avoid the whole characterization of the transfer as a loan, but it is unavoidable, because if someone accepts Achrayus Onsen, that makes him automatically a lover. So, we are setting up a partnership, and if there was a silence regarding the division of profits and losses, the Gemara says, Stam Iska, Palga, Lova, Halvoa, Palga, is because we regard it as a division of profits and losses, being 50-50, 50% of the profits will be taken by the financier, and he will assume 50% of losses if there are losses. However, any symmetrical stipulation on the part of the financier is valid. The financier can tell the recipient, I'm giving you money, Bitaris Iska, which means that the financier is going to be a silent partner, and I will take 90% of the profit. You will only take 10% of the profits. But if there are losses, then I will assume 90% of the losses, and you will assume only 10% of the losses. That's called symmetrical. Why does it have to be that way? Because there is one element of upper ribbis, when Rabbanim prohibited on a rabbinical level, ribbis, is a transaction which has nothing to do with halvah, but is characterized as karav Leschar Varofa Lehesh. If a person gives money to someone else on terms that is near to profit and far from loss from the standpoint of the financier, the one that gave the money, that is prohibited. That type of transaction is prohibited on a rabbinical level because of the Iser of Avah Ribbis. You have someone over the barrel, in other words, and giving him money on terms which are very favorable to you. You're taking a disproportionate share of the gain. So as any asymmetrical terms which is favorable to the financier is called Carveless Car Roth Lehepson. So one very important provision of Het Iska is that it has to be set up as a symmetrical division of profits and losses. And we will see a little later that the original Het Iska just set it up stop Iska, which would make it automatically a split down the middle of profits and losses. There is, in the modern transactions, there is a definite advantage of not doing it that way, but rather making it mostly if it costs like 90% of the profits will go to the financier, and the financier will assume 90% of the losses. This will be a distinct advantage that will be very helpful. We'll see that a little later. But there's another provision that's very important, and this might seem to be a minor item, but it's very vital, and the whole restructuring would not get us out of the problem of ribbons unless we would include this little item. It might seem little, but it's very important. And that's called Schar Tircha. That the managing partner must be given some amount of money for his toil and effort in managing the enterprise. As long as they stipulate this merosh, from the beginning of the relationship, it could be a nominal sum. It could be a dollar. But the managing partner must be given some amount of money for his Schar Tircha. Why? It is because the relationship that is defined between partners is one of a financier and a managing partner. The portion that the managing partner assumes the risk of, that he is accepting responsibility for loss, as we discussed before, even though nothing was said about loan, but it takes on the character of a loan. And since the managing partner is accepting some part of risk, some part of the loss he is accepting, so unless we would give him some sarakirka for managing the enterprise, it would seem that he is accepting that onerous responsibility to manage the enterprise in the interest of both partners as a necessary means of getting the loan portion of the transfer. There is some portion of the transfer that is a loan, and if the managing partner is going to work for nothing, so that is a disguised interest payment that he is paying for that portion of the transfer that's a loan in the form of working for nothing in the interest of both of them. So if he is given some amount of compensation for his toil and effort, then we would not look upon the portion of the transfer that he's accepting upon himself as accepting the loss as a disguised interest payment. We wouldn't look upon the work as a disguised interest payment because he is getting compensated. Now, even though he's only accepting a dollar, as long as he accepts it, this would be regarded as compensation of his work, removing this problem. It's a small item, but it's very essential that it should be here.
Why can't this percentage be considered payment? And why are they saying that it's considered a loan?
To give him a little more percentage. That is another way to do it. You
no,
give
the original percentage. Why would he say that? Why would he say that that's
okay, no, because see, it's a partnership. See, there is a portion of the money that's being transferred to this fellow that has to be regarded halakhically as a loan. Right? That's the portion that he assumes responsibility for. This is only one, the managing partner alone is providing his labor and managerial services, right? So it seems as if he is agreeing to do this for nothing in order to get the transfer of money. And that's certainly true, right? He's agreeing to these terms. The fact is that part of the transfer is characterized as a loan. So he seems to be working for nothing in order to induce the financier to give him the money. It's a disguised form of interest. So we have to remove that concern, and we do it by the Schat Yerucha. Yes?
Before, you said that in order to avoid avagrimus, it has to be symmetrical.
Yeah. It shouldn't be. It should not be characterized as car of the Schat, but off of the Hesed. So if the financier would insist on terms that are not symmetrical from his, and would be favorable from his standpoint. In other words, you say, as far as profits, I'm going to take 90% of the profits. As far as the losses, I'm going to take only 10% of the losses. Like a real lopsided deal. So it's Karl Lefar, Rav Lehesek, and the Rabbanim would prohibit such type of deal.
But as long as it's symmetrical, the size of it doesn't matter, right?
No, it doesn't matter, because if you can't characterize it as Karl Lefar, Rav Lehesek, if I want 90% of the profits, but I'm willing to assume 90% of the losses, it's a fair deal. No, this is already takes out of the character the problem of making it symmetrical, Carlos Scott Ruffalo has it, as long as it's symmetrical. Now, that's the basic form, and that essentially is mentioned in Mar Makomas in the Gemara. That the ingenious idea in the 1550s was to add a few little wrinkles to this in order to ensure that the person that gave the money, that he'll actually end up with a dividend, with a profit. And the idea was as follows. We have two elements that, let us say we set it up in the ordinary way that it's stam iska. So it's 50, we know right away what that means. That's interpreted as 50% division of profits and losses. And it's satirfa set up. Now, the financier may say as follows. That I will insist that when you report to me the profits of the ISPA, I only will accept your report by means of a shvua hamura, a solemn oath. And Ramosha Zasal in his truly says that you can get the most mileage out of this as you want. The financier could say, I want a shvua hamura, which means Nikita's favor, so you have to hold the Sefer Torah, make a shvua that this was what was earned, the profits that were earned, and I want you to make it ben asher l'chol zion barabim, the shul, not privately, so you'll be. And also, you should accept upon yourself all kinds of klalos, if you're saying a full soul, maximum mileage out of this. That is sure to scare off the managing partner. And we assume that a Jew, an observant Jew, abjures to make oaths, even if he's saying, testifying something which is emes. He just doesn't want to make a shvuah. So, we have a provision that in case you do not want to accept the oath, you don't feel right taking an oath, then I will accept what is called the schachis pashrus, the compromise sum. There'll be a certain amount of money that I will accept as a financier, as my prorated share of the profits. So if you want to get out of the oath, I'm giving you an opportunity. You can buy it off. This is buying. You buy off your responsibility to make an oath by giving me the size boxes, and I will regard this as my prorated share of the profits. Okay. Now, what about the losses? The losses, the way the original Het Isco was set up was aiding to do it. That I only will accept your statement regarding losses by means of the testimony of designated witnesses. This is a very stringent type of requirement. He designates some people. Now, the past right away understood, the Shulchan Aruch, that this lends itself to abuse. Because it so happened that some people that wanted to make a sham out of the Het Isco, and they wanted to make sure that it would be impossible to verify that there were losses, they selected as the Eidim Yiduim, the Rav and the Chas of the base of the Kehillah, and they wouldn't have any knowledge at all of the business transactions. They wouldn't be able to testify firsthand that knowing that there were losses. So it would be impossible to prove that there were losses. Now the Torah says quite explicitly that if you're setting up Eidim Yiduim, you're designating people to be the witnesses, and they have no knowledge at all of the Iskra, then it makes it into a sham. And you're really setting up a mechanism that's impossible. And it's just a circumvention of ribbons. So these Eidim Yiduim, they really have to be people that are at least slightly conversant with the Isba. And we're getting into dangerous ground, though, of course, because it really is a fine line between an impossibility and close to an impossibility. So this, I think that as time we went historically with this Het Isco, that it now is just Eidim shared we have. We don't have Eidim Yiduim. Like somebody makes a star Het Isco, usually won't designate witnesses. We'll just say they have to be kosher according to Din Torah. But that's also a very strange condition. Where are you going to find Eidim shared though? This is a raises the question, is it a circumvention if you write Eidim shared? I think this is going to be a problem where we want to point to the need to modify the Het Isco. But I think this is a very big problem of to say that you're going to have Eidim Kesherim that only their testimony. Because you have to have people that are really Eidim Kesherim, and they have to be conversant with the Het Isco, with the whole business transaction. Yes.
This is kind of the idea again that you have to pay the sum of money or not take the oath.
Okay, see, there is a underlying assumption here in this whole mechanism. The underlying assumption is that the managing partner would abjure to take the oath. This would shake him up terribly. And he would prefer to pay the size costs. This is a compromise sum that the financier agrees that he will regard as his prorated share of the profit. So, we presume that this is a predictable scenario. This is what's going to happen. We can be, with confidence, we can predict this in advance. The financier wants to realize a dividend on his transfer of capital. If he wants to know, effectively, he wants to earn interest. So, he's giving the money to this person, the Torah Iskov. And he's pretty sure that he will opt not to take the oath and he'll pay him the size costs. That's how he's going to get his profit. The loss, that's even less worried because he's designating Eidim Yiduim or Eidim Kesherim. And only through their testimony is it believable that there were losses. This sets up a procedure which generates a high degree of confidence that from the standpoint of the financier, he's going to get back his money, right? Plus, he's going to get a dividend as well. So this transfers the loan into a business partnership which has good safeguards that there will be a return of the capital as well as a dividend that's earned. Yes?
He makes dividends, but really didn't cash throughout the 80s. Where did he come in?
Okay, these people are supposed to be at least slightly conversant with the business that's supposed to take place. So they're supposed to know about the ISPA. And if there was a loss, they could know about it. Not that they definitely would know about it. They could know about it. There's at least the possibility that they would know about it. So what the financier is insisting, that if you want to claim that there was a loss, I'm only going to accept such a claim by means of the testimony of these two individuals. That makes it almost impossible for the managing partner to claim that there was a loss. He was setting up very stringent requirements for that to be a valid claim, acceptable claim.
The managing partner to pay money to get out of the screw up?
Well, he's saying, your obligation essentially is this. He tells the managing partner, there's an ISPA term, this ISPA is going to go on for a certain term, it could be for a year, okay? And he's saying, I want periodic reports every month, I want reports how the ISPA is doing. I want reports, profit loss reports. But the way, my method of accepting the report is as follows. I only will accept your report of profits by means of a solemn oath. I only accept your claim that there were losses if you can back it up with the ADIM you do it, or the ADIM share. Yes? Let me just point out, but my whole purpose here today is I want to show that we should, this has the ISCA, if we can't, Ramosha says, I'll use the expression, that some people regard it as a lachash, as an incantation, as a kameya, you know, like it's a magical word, and that kashes up everything. So there is, if we take this as a very serious document, then we have to be concerned with it, both from a halachic standpoint and also from a practical standpoint. In other words, if just imagine yourself, a businessman is going into a deal, and the deal makes absolutely no sense from a business standpoint, that he's exposing himself to enormous risk, then the whole thing really is a sham. Because this has to be taken seriously. Now, the point brought up about, you're saying that just the opposite, maybe it's very easy for them to claim. Now, that certainly, in some transactions, there's a possibility that there could be a self-evident loss. For example, let's say the ISCO was real estate. It was a building. And during this time, there was a depression in real estate values. The self-evident loss, and at any time, there's a real estate mortgage, which is 30 years, 25 years, this has to be taken into account. If we're looking at this in a serious manner, then we can take into account your point, that sometimes the loss would be self-evident, and therefore there would be no need, it would be wrong, ethically wrong, to require the agent you're doing, or the agent you share, when the loss is self-evident. This is
there. It's
not evident. No, well, so can the whole world. We don't need them. They don't have. We don't have. We will not actually require them to testify because it is a self-evident loss. See, so this is a practical problem with the Heta Iskra. Yes.
Isn't there a possibility for abuse on the side of the managing partner, because if he wants to, let's say he has more loss and more profit. I mean, generally, isn't the
okay? There's another point. I'm guessing you anticipate my next point. This is another provision of the Het Iskra, which usually is absent. Ramosha Zatzal just mentions the Derech Agav. He says it should be put in as well. And that is, there should be a little clause that says that in the event that the prorated share of the financier came out to be more than the sum that he's actually getting. Let's say there was some mistake made. And really, it was miscalculation. It was really more. So there is a mechila on the part of the financier, so that it should not be regarded as gever. This is something that is often overlooked, but it should be there as well. We have to cover all bases. should not be regarded as get. Now, yes.
Why can't you, for the laws, why can't you use the same thing as the shul?
Okay, that is a complicated thing. It's going to take a lot of time to explain that. So if we have time at the end, we'll get to that, all right? It's a good question. But I would refer you to the chapter in my book, The Antiquity of the Jewish Law, that explains that point. We don't get to it. Okay, but now, next thing is this. How useful is this Heter Iska? The capital transfer has to be for Iska purposes, for business purposes. Because what are we doing here? It's not a lachash. We're setting up a partnership. So if someone is making a capital available to someone else for purely personal use, it's not an Iska. And it does not... We cannot restructure that transaction by means of Heter Iska to legitimize the receipt of dividends. So the question is, how broadly do we define Iska? The broadest conceptualization of Iska is the Shalomation, the Lemberger Rav Zatzal, that he claims that any transfer that makes it possible for a person to continue his present livelihood activity would be regarded broadly as an Iska. So the case that he dealt with was a teacher that wanted a loan. Was the question is, can we make that loan available for Torah's Iska? And he said, yes, this would be an Iska, because the intended use of the loan, even though it was purely for personal consumption, to buy his food, buy clothing, pay the rent, but this allowed him to get along and obviated the need to leave his profession and seek a higher paying job elsewhere. So it's, in the broad sense, it's an Iska, because it allows him to preserve his livelihood activities. That's like really stretching things. But Shalomation says that's Iska. Another example, he says if someone would receive money, which would allow him to keep his home, and to avoid a forced sale of his home, that's also Iska, because it obviates the need to liquidate his residence, his home, and rent the park. That preserves his way of living. That's even a broader way of looking at Iska, that his lifestyle is preserved. That's also Iska. Now that's really stretching things very far. Because Imre Yosha, or Meir Arik, argues, and he says that Iska can only be viewed as an authentic business, some kind of a business asset has to be acquired with the money for the purpose of generating profit. So he takes a very narrow view, and in the same with Rishi Huda, he claims that this is really the mainstream view, Rav Meir Arik, that we have to view Iska very narrowly. Now, let's look at something which would be very helpful in modifying this basic Het Iska that was thought up in the 1550s. Now, right away we would have a problem that if the Iska that is selected is something that would not generate profit, it would be a big risk involved. Now, take for example, real estate, let's say a mortgage, which is a very frequent transaction. We mentioned this before, that if we take the head of Iska very seriously, we don't regard it just as a lachash. Right away, there's a problem, because don't forget, a mortgage is not for a year, it's for 24 to 30 years. So we're talking about a private mortgage that involves Jews. We'll get to in a corporation in a few minutes. But we have private mortgage. This is a very long-term thing. And there's certainly going to be slumps in the real estate market. And there will be instances of just periods of time that will lead, there'll be self-evident losses, which we mentioned before. That's one thing. Another thing is that, yes, it is true that we can regard the house as an Iska, because it is something that will naturally appreciate. Anything that naturally appreciates, we can regard as an Iska. Even though people buy a home, it is for is a chunk of living, but it's not bought as a speculative deal. It's true, but a house is something that will naturally appreciate, and therefore it is authentically an ispa. But it's very difficult to measure what kind of appreciation took place. In fact, I would submit that the only time that you could really know what was the actual appreciation of the house, if you are seriously selling it and you have actually closed the deal, then you will know what it's worth. There has to be an actual transaction, a sale. If it's, everything is hypothetical, make believe. Suppose I want to sell my house right now, and I went into the head to ISCO agreement with this fellow 2 months ago. The house didn't appreciate. Didn't appreciate. So I said, yes, but I don't know how much. How can I make a shvua affirming of what the appreciation was? It was not beyond a certain amount. Is it really possible to make a shvua? Honestly, it wouldn't, the imposition of the shvua upon me by the financier, wouldn't that amount to, as a pastor, if you impose a shvua on someone and you know that this would be a false shvua, then the person that imposed the shvua is guilty of shvua shav, imposing a false shvua. So does the financier have a right even to impose a shvua when you're dealing with real estate, something that's ephemeral and not subject to valuation, precise valuation, that is? So how can you make a shvua? This is a definite difficulty. The whole mechanism, on a very frequent transaction, you want to use it, a private mortgage, and if there's difficulty with from a practical standpoint, I'm saying we take that ISCA seriously. So is there really a permissibility on the part of the financier to insist on a shvua? And of course, there could be instances of self-evident loss. Yes.
Does the shvua have to be exactly how much money is appreciated, or just that it's appreciated?
Well, he has to give him a statement. He has to say, "I made a shvua that it did not appreciate more than this amount." So unless he's actually going to sell the property, he can't really be sure of that. We're getting into gray areas of a possibility of making a false shvua. Yes.
You're talking about the knowledge. I mean, I don't see, let's say even if it certainly goes up, where is there a profit? My house doubles in price, but I don't know.
Oh, so there's a business asset that appreciated, which means that if it was sold, there are certain profits involved, and you could assist, you could give the person a part of these profits, because the asset appreciated. Yeah, even though they're unrealized, I could give you a share of your profits. There's no problem with that. So that's really the ISCA, the depreciation in the house. So right away it becomes desirable to make use of this, what Rameh Arak, he's the one who came up with this idea. We call this the substitution clause. This is very useful that we specify that we're making a capital transfer for ISCA purposes, and all the business assets of the managing partner will guarantee the ISPA, which means that anyone could substitute for the ISPA. So essentially we're saying we're making on a prorated basis the financier partner in all the business that the managing partner has. So, and Ramosh Natal explains it as follows. Like, it's, I think, a very good, very sharp insight into why this, although not mentioned Rameh Arak, but he's the one that is given credit for thinking of this idea, that it's really a question of freeing money. If someone, for example, requests money to buy a house, so he may very well have other money, but he needs the other money for other business purposes. So by giving the money to the house, it really frees other money to be invested elsewhere. So it's really anything really could be called the ISPA. Any business activity that is done in that period of time can be viewed as the ISPA, because it's a question of freeing money that he would not otherwise have, and it could assume many different forms. So this is the idea of guaranteeing everything by means of the other business assets that are required. Now this thing would be, I think, extremely useful in what we talked about in the beginning, in the installment plan purchase. It would be very useful. Let's say someone comes in to a store to make a purchase of a washing machine. So he doesn't want it paid in cash. He wants it paid in installment plan with interest added. So this involves Rivas Derech Nakach America, which is also, which is the Drabbanim also. So what can be done is that the what would be regarded here as the ISPA? The ISPA is the washing machine that is given to this consumer. And of course, this is not a business asset, but it is Shavu Kesef. So we say, I'm giving you this Bitaris ISPA, and you have the obligation to take its equivalent value and invest it in something for the interest of both of us. That's how we trigger, this is how we launch the ISPA. We launch the ISPA transaction by requiring the consumer that's acquiring the washing machine to take its equivalent value, let's say it's $1,000, and invest it in some kind of business in the interest of both the storekeeper and himself. So this is a substitution clause. Now, the consumer, he may have, for example, his house, which he has equity in, which he could, that would be something to give a share in it to the storekeeper. And as I mentioned before, that is not really a good idea because real estate is not subject to precise measurement of what would be the appreciation. But there are other things that he can give a prorated share of that would have $1,000 equivalent value, like he has a bank account, for instance. Mentioned before, the advantage of having 90%, the half risk is set up not as 50-50, but rather a 90% assumption of profits by the financier and 90% of the losses. So this could get him a interest rate close to what he wants. It would seem to me that in business transactions, this may not be enough. Like today, if you would look at what kind of interest rate people are paying in installment plans, they're paying a very hefty interest rate. It could be 10%, it could be more. It varies, but it could be a lot more than what your average consumer would have, which we could pass on as an ISPA. Somebody that has a bank account, that's an ISPA. So by making 90% of the interest of $1,000 go to the financier, the storekeeper, and that's helpful. But it may not be enough, because if he's only earning 4% in the bank account, this may not satisfy the person. So I think an ASUP that you certainly could be done is that the financier could say what he wants the ISPA to be. He could say that he wants the $1,000, which is the value of the ISPA he's giving, and it has to be a substitute thing that's bought, business assets for. He could say that he wants the person to invest in, let us say, in money market. So he could tell what the ISPA is. And if the person refuses, he certainly could have a clause saying that he's entitled to the differential. As long as it's a safe investment, let us say that there is possibility of getting 8 or 9% on some kind of money market. He could say, I want you to invest in the Oppenheimer Fund. This, and give, and 90% of it profit, I will assume, and 90% of the loss. Case there is bankruptcy and this is not insured, so there is certainly a valid possibility of a loss. That would be helpful, and if the person doesn't want to do that, there could certainly be a clause for every reason. He's afraid that Merrill Lynch will declare bankruptcy. He only wants to put the money in bank, which is guaranteed by the FDIC. And there are many people like that who just shy away from anything that involves any kind of risk. So the financier certainly can specify what he wants the ISPA to be. And in the event that there is a differential of what the person actually invests in, which he gives me permission to, he will get the differential. That is certainly legitimate. And that would be helpful in getting closer to what the interest rate that he wants. Now, in terms of the mortgage, that there is difficulty of using the usual had to ISPA because of the possibility of self-evident loss and the difficulty of precisely measuring what the appreciation wants of the property. So what Rav Moshe Zatzal suggests in his tshuva is that you could use a different mechanism entirely, but has nothing to do with Hetter Hiskov, which solves this problem. Now, what is the objective here? That someone wants, let's say, $20,000 for the purpose of buying a home. So, what we could do is, we could first give the $20,000, he will invest the financier with that portion of the equity that equals the $20,000 of his home. So, somebody's buying a house, and he will have some equity in the house, and as long as that equity, which means the portion that belongs to the owner, the person that is buying it now, he can assign the person that's giving the money that amount in the house. And the payment of interest and principal, which is the way mortgage payments are worked, the way it's structured in the conventional manner, is that there's some payment that monthly is made, which is amortization, which is running down the principal. There's a loan, so you're paying off the loan. Some portion is for that purpose. And the other portion is interest. So you have them combined, interest and amortization, as is called. And in the initial phases of the mortgage, it's mostly interest, and it's so structured and very little amortization, which is beneficial for the homeowner's tax purposes, because you deduct interest. So what we can do here is that we have nothing to do with that fiscal. We have the person that's getting the money will assign the person that transfers him the money a equity ownership in his home equal to the transfer. And the payments that will be made by the buyer of the home to the person who gave the money will be conceived as rent. And the way it will be done is that each time he pays rent, that he will partially be buying up that portion that is presently owned by the financier. Yet the financier's equity will be reduced each month because part of the payment that the purchaser of this home will be making will be to buy up that portion of the home that belongs to the financier. So each month the payment is going to be adjusted so that he will only be paying rent, which is the interest really, for that portion that of the home that still belongs to the financier. So eventually it will be all paid up because each time there's a payment that is made, some portion of that equity that's owned by the financier will be reacquired, will be acquired by the one who bought the home. Yes?
You say the interest is really the rent, right? The other part is...
Yes, the interest would be the rent, and the other portion would be buying up, right, the portion of the home that's owned by the financier. So eventually, the entire home will be owned by the purchaser. And this is a, there is a problem, though. There's a practical problem. And because the way mortgage usually works, what happens if there's a default? What would happen? So who would take possession? The mortgagee would take possession, the one that extended the capital. He would have the right to sell the home and recover as much of his transfer that he made, right? But in the way we're setting things up here, we're making them partner. That the home will be partially owned by the every time rent is paid by the purchaser of the house, he will be acquiring some ownership, some more equity in the house. And at some point, if it is sold because of default, they will have to be divided up in a certain way. And this, from a practical standpoint, again, we're taking this seriously. We're taking all these mechanisms with the seriousness that they should have as business transactions, that this would possibly not be palatable from the standpoint of the one that's giving the money, that this should be the consequence. So this can be adjusted very simply, modified a little bit, and simply we could have the ownership of the home completely vested in the financier until the entire payments are made. And then at the end, the ownership can be transferred. So that way, this would make any type of liquidation that's done before all the payments are made, who would be the owner? It would be the financier. He would be able to recover his money. And this would be, from a practical standpoint, much more powerful. Okay, meow. Yes, question?
Yes, the three years and what they give is $20,000. So if that's treated as a loan, is the rivet to give him the entire house rather than just $20,000 for the house, even for the time period that
he... Well, the stipulation is made that it's a leasehold arrangement, and it will revert into a sale when all the payments are made. So this wouldn't violate Ribbis at all, because what is being paid all along is rent. But title of ownership is not only translated.
Why did the executive have financier on the money part of it when it's sold and the regime gone part of it?
From a practical standpoint, because most people, the way conventional mortgage works is, if there's a default, then the financier has the right to sell the property and recover whatever his loan was. So this from a practical standpoint, this probably could be demanded. All right, now let's get something else. That, yes.
Can you elaborate a little on what the solution is mentioned? You make the financier the full owner of the house.
Until all the payments are made. Until then, it's just a leasehold arrangement, meaning that the purchaser will be paying rent. But when all the rent is paid, which will include, of course, the interest and the return of the principal, then the ownership will be transferred to the purchaser. He's getting back his principal plus interest every time a payment is made. So when all the payments are made, effectively he has gotten back his money. So at that point, we should transfer ownership to the one that made the purchased the house.
But meanwhile, the financier is holding those principal payments, right? So that's what we...
Meanwhile, he has ownership of the house, because this was the agreement. There's nothing wrong with such an agreement that $20,000 you have, that's your equity share, and you keep it the whole time. That is not gradually reduced. You keep it the whole time, because since it's your house, I pay you rent for living in your house. But all the payments are made, which effectively means that I gave him back the $20,000 plus all the interest that he wanted. At that point, the title of ownership should be transferred. That's a stipulation that's made. Okay. Yes.
Does it make sense for something in which one should have equity, for example, in Rose's house?
Yeah.
But how would you fit that into a situation where there is no equity? For example, yeah. Somebody borrowing a couple $1,000 to make a wedding. You can't keep your financier 30% of your wedding.
Right.
See, you got to pay back the money, the wedding is gone.
Okay. All right. So that is the advantage of the substitution clause. You get the money and you get right away, you have permission to use the money for personal expenses, the wedding expenses, but you are obligating yourself to take the equivalent of that, the $3,000, and invest in the interest of both you and the financier as some kind of business asset, which would mean...
You should have some other assets.
Right. So if you don't, you're like, you're stuck. Absolutely. If you don't have a bank account, you don't have a house, you're right. That this would not be about mechanism. Absolutely. It has to be some kind of asset. Correct. So, Neil, the next problem, yes.
What happens if the business is more prosperous than would be the normal interest rate?
Yeah, well, there's no problem. As long as this was, in fact, the case, that there's an ISCA and the... Like to say, the question that's asked is, the financier may never want to insist upon the shvua. So maybe the ISCA, as reported by this very excited fellow that wanted to invest in some point in the stock market or something, maybe he really made a killing. So they would have to give him half, whatever it was, or 90%, he would be very happy. There's no problem there. That could be a surprise.
The point of an interest arrangement is that you try to keep things in a standard.
But see, the fact, the courts transaction altogether, because that's how it should be. It should be a restructuring, and therefore it can't possibly violate usury laws. That was a ruling of the court.
No, but I'm talking just from the borrower's perspective.
Yeah.
You want to know that your interest payment will be limited to a certain amount that you can make for your profit. So basically, you're saying in an ISCO agreement, because it's basically a variable rate.
Yeah, well, yes, because it's whatever the ISCA earns, there's a certain division, a symmetrical division of profits and losses. And he could get out of that by paying the Sahih's Pashas, because he has to only report it through a Shavua, see, that's mentioned before. All right, now, let's get to another issue about a corporation. If the borrower is a corporation, does that go under the Iser of Rivas? Rabosha Zasal takes a view that if the borrower is a corporation, it will not be considered as a loga, as a borrower. And this view was stated earlier by the Marshak, Shlomo Greenberg, was the first one that proposed this idea. Now, Rabosha Zasal says just how he swore. Says that what is a loaner, a person that has really an obligation to pay back the loan, whatever is possible for him to do to pay it back. He has a mitzvah to repay his loan, so it's really a shibud haguf. He has to do whatever he can. He has to get a job and somehow raise the money and pay back the loan. There is a very onerous obligation on the part of a loaner. But when you look at corporate structure, of limited liability. If the borrower is the corporate entity, that means that there is only a lien on the assets of the corporation. And the owners of the shareholders of the corporation are not liable beyond that. There's no personal liability. There's no shibud haguf on the shareholders of the corporation. So Rav Moshe takes a view that If that is the extent of the obligation that the loaver is making, and he's saying that you can only collect from the specific assets of the corporation, and not beyond that, there's nothing beyond that, that removes the character of a loaver. That's not a loaver altogether. Now, that view is very sharply disputed by the Chelkas Yaakov, the Minchas Yitzchak, and the Bris Yehuda, so it seems that is not a mainstream view. That would make things a lot easier to rely on that in modern transactions, but it is sharply disputed because it's a svara, and it still, it would seem that the other people take the dispute that they do not regard shibud haguf as being essential to create the status of a loaner. When you look at the corporation, assuming that it is like treated like a person, because in halacha we would just treat a corporation as a shutis, because there is no such a bilus in the Gemara of a legal entity onto itself. Corporation. So we would have to view it as simply a shutvus, wherein the certain conditions are stipulated among the partners that they are letting the world know limited liability, that this is the extent of our liability. Yes.
According to most people, they say that what about if say companies owned.
Oh, okay. All right. So the question is, what would establish a Jewish company that would be under the rubric of Iser Rivas? So the view that's adopted by most of the Achronim is that if there is majority ownership of the corporation that is Jewish, of the shareholders are Jewish, or even if that is not the case, but the managers, people that have control of the disposition of the assets, if they are Jewish, which I think would at least mean that if the CEO, the chief executive officer of the corporation, if he is Jewish, which means he has the authority to dispose of the assets of the corporation, that itself would make it a Jewish company and it would be under the Iser of Rivas.
Okay.
So there is, in fact, it's interesting, there is a view, which is a Das Yochid, the Minchas Yitzchak takes the view that if someone is a non-voting owner, like there's, we're going to deal with that in a minute, this is preferred stock, which is non-voting, he has no day at all, he collects his dividend that is stipulated, if there is, of course, enough money in the company to give the dividend, but he has no say whatsoever in the operation of the business. He cannot elect board of directors or anything. It's called a non-voting owner of a corporation. The Minchas Yitzchak takes the view that this is mamish like someone, a mouth, as somebody to a guy. You lend money to a guy and you stipulate with him that he will be entitled to a certain percentage of his profits. So Shulchan Aruch says, if you lend money to a guy and you stipulate that you get in his business a certain percentage of profits, the guy decides to do business on Shabbos. It's not Master Shabbos at all, and there's no problem whatsoever because you are not an owner, a pilot in the business. So he claims, Mr. Yitzchak, that if someone is a non-voting owner in a corporation, the corporation would be open on Shabbos. It's not a problem at all because you're just essentially a malva. And this is very sharply disputed, this concept, because in case of liquidation of assets, the non-voting shareholder is a real violent. That's the fact. That's the law. It's a difficult view to take that say he's only a malva. He's an owner. There's no question. He is a partner in the business, and he has a claim on the assets. When all the creditors are satisfied, then what will happen? When all the creditors are satisfied, then he will be a residual claimant in the company. And he's a real buyer. So he is, it's his business. It's open on Shabbos. He's a partner. How could he? So this Kohelet Yaakov disputes Minchas Yitzchak and Rav Moshe Sternbach, Moadim Zmanim, very sharply disputes it also. So I think that's a Das Yochid, to view a non-voting shareholder as only a malva. And we'll get to that in a minute. But I want to point out, within this context of a corporation, which frequently you find that there are a lot of loan transactions that will take place when the loan is a corporation, that the whole structure of the head to Yitzchak really doesn't make sense at all. When you talk about the Shavua and the Eidim Yidur, in the light of this modern mechanism, the corporation, for instance, and to take the example of the Shavua, that you're asking, for example, the treasurer of the corporation, some officer of the corporation, to say that you're giving the corporation money to invest in the interest of both the financier and itself, and you want to report profits and losses periodically, and you're only going to accept the report of profits through a solemn oath that somebody has to make. Let's say it's the treasurer of the corporation, the controller, okay? Now, what does this insistence on an oath mean? It means first-hand knowledge. So if you want to know a higher level of veracity and verification of what's going on than would otherwise be obtained. Now, the larger the corporation gets, the more people are involved in the transactions that are recorded in the balance sheet and the profit and loss statements. There could be even hundreds of people that are involved in directly or indirectly in producing the income statement and the various transactions that went on. So when this officer, who is far removed from the actual purchases that are made, accounts receivable, accounts payable, and transactions that actually took place were just fictitious, what does he know more than what he can read off the balance sheet? He doesn't have any higher level of knowledge of what took place than what is recorded in these books that is proud of perhaps even hundreds of different transactions, which depend, the veracity of this statement depends in the final analysis on the efficiency and the honesty of many, many people and their interactions. So what sense does it make to ask someone to make a shvua when he doesn't really know anything more than what the financial statements say? he could take out the financial statement that it was the work of hundreds of people, and he could read it to you and say, this is what we earned last month. This is the profits that we earned. This is the loss that we earned last month. Beyond that, what is he going to do? What sense it becomes a kulcha v'tzalula, the whole idea of shvur, because it doesn't add anything. The shvur can't possibly add anything from what the information that the officer has. And the idea of agent share is really an impossibility. How could it be possible within the framework of a modern corporation that does a large-scale business, a far-flung business? And even, I'm not talking about the huge corporations, even the small ones. It's busy. There are many, many people that are involved. It's not possible. It already becomes an impossibility that you're asking that it should be verified through agent share. How could any two people know about all the transactions and testify? It's simply an impossibility. Yes. So it would seem that really we have to modify the head to Iskut, and we have to retain the same objective. The objective is that we are giving money and we're making a symmetrical division of profits and losses, and we want to ensure ourselves that we'll end up with a certain dividend out of this deal, right? But there's quite a lot of risk involved. If we just leave it the way it is in its naked form, to say, I'll give you $100,000 and we'll divide our profits and losses. I'll take 90% of the profits and I'll take 90% of the losses. Could very well be that they will lose the money or that there won't be too much profits at all. So there is really a big reluctance for anyone to provide capital for business purposes when he's dealing with a corporation. And how is he going to ensure that he's going to get in return what he wants? So it seems to me that you could do with the following. Instead of having the shvua there, you could have the person that's giving the money, and this is simply obtained by a knowledge of accounting practices and the balance sheet and the profit and loss statement. You have various accounting methods can be used in arriving at it. And there's a lot of variation and flexibility in accounting methods of how you report transactions. For example, how you would figure out depreciation. That's a key idea. Depreciation of the capital asset. There are different methods, but I'm not going into that. But there's quite a lot of variation, and that is tolerated in the accounting profession. And an inventory valuation, reserves, bad debts. So the bottom line is profits, but it all depends how are you going to evaluate inventory, how are you going to depreciate capital assets, what are you going to set aside for bad debt. It depends on all that, and then you'll have your final profit statement. So it would seem that the person giving the money, he could just by asking a few questions, he could come up with an accounting procedure that's different, considerably different than what the firm is using, and he could say, well, fine, you know, we're going to divide the profit losses, 90% profit, so I get 90% losses, I'll take, but I only will accept the statement if you use my accounting methods, the way I want you to do it. If you want to use your own methods, which, I will not accept it, but if you want to, if you pay me this high as kashrus, then I will accept that this will be my prorated share of the profits. For the rest, I don't really trust you because I don't want to calculate profits the way you do. I think it's much better, a fairer picture of what's going on to use my methods. And I have a right to select methods that I think are advantageous as far as my investment is concerned. I want to protect my investment. And I only want profits and losses to be reported by these methods. Then I'll get a fair shake, or else you're just going to run circles around me and tell me that you have no profits. So I want you to use my methods. And in case you don't want to use my methods, I will agree to this sum that this amounts to my prorated share of the profits. This, I think, could work in a lot of instances. And as an alternative idea, there could be, if the corporation is not public, which I think would be the most instances and Jewish inter-Jewish transactions. It would not be a public corporation. I wouldn't be lending, giving money to General Motors or someone else of that sort. If we're concerned with inter-Jewish transactions, it's very common, as you know, in all businesses that it's a tightly held private corporation, family owned, could be very extensive, their business, their dealings. But it's a privately owned company. It's not a publicly owned company. I think that's realistically when we were dealing with problems of business, we would be dealing with a privately held corporation. But the law states that only a public corporation requires a public audit. That's the law. There has to be a public audit, which means independent verification of all of the financial statements. In other words, you hire a CPA and a public corporation, and they check out the various statements and assertions and the financial statement, and they put their stamp on it, certified public accountant, and that is an essential requirement if a company's shares are traded in the stock market. They have to, it's a public corporation, anyone can own it, it's required, they have a audit. But a private corporation is not required to have this. So, first you can say simply this, that I'm giving you this money, and I will only accept profits and losses if there's an audit. An independent audit. Now, an independent audit is a costly affair. And this is something that's not powerful. It probably is even it's less powerful than making a shmur, because it costs money. So if you insist upon this, this is the way. If you don't want it, have an independent audit. Why do I want an independent audit? Because I don't trust you. You claim the profit and losses. I want to make sure this is true. I want an independent audit. And if you don't want it, fine. I'll accept the highest posthumous, this sum, this as my prorated share of the profits, no further questions asked. But it's something that is within the capability of the company to do, and it is reasonable for me to ask that, because I'm making an investment, and I am worried about my money. I want to make sure I'm not cheated by anybody, so I want everything to be verified. And if you don't want to do it, fine. Pay the highest posthumous. This works equally well as far as profits and losses are concerned. I don't need two different methods. A, do you do them or swore? I just need one thing. I just need an audit. You agree to that? Fine. If you don't want the audit, just pay me the size fashion. So I will accept that as my share of the profits.
We'll go on a couple of questions. Think before the previous suggestion that the accounting procedure,
yeah.
Meaning one should specify this in the original star, say whatever I choose at the time of saying.
No, that would be already a question of a smachta. Like you say, I'll determine it later. So then if the other party agrees, so then it's a shiloh basmachta. You have to say up front, before you draw up the star, you have to ask the right questions to know what methods they use and to know what you would insist upon. So everything is up front. You can't say, tell them that I will decide later. I'll look at what you're doing. That's like pulling a fast one on them, and then if they agree, in the beginning, Mirosh, it's a shayla basmachta.
So therefore, if you have to specify, say, if these accounting procedures X, Y, Z, right, or if you start.
Yeah, and if you don't want to use my method, you feel it's too cumbersome, it upsets the routine of the firm, whatever reason that they don't want to do it, I will accept the shayla basmachta as my prorate share.
Now, this other method,
yeah.
Whose expense?
Their expense. I'm saying this because I don't trust them. So they, of course, they have to pay for it. This is just a guarantee, an assurance that this is what happened during the term of the transaction. See, this is not at all a problem with RIPs, because we have to remember something very critical about RIPs. That what RIPs is schar avanata. The Torah prohibited payment for the waiting of your money. That is the nature of ribbons. If I want them to make an order, I don't gain by the order. It's not a payment to me altogether. It is a payment to another party for service rendered authenticating their data. So it has absolutely nothing to do with ribbons, and I am not in any way gaining other than being assured that everything, that the transactions transpired as claimed. So it's not in any way a shiloh ribbis insisting upon an authentication that may cost the person got the money, may cost them something to do. Okay. Now, Now, there's another very important type of transaction that will frequently, that involves a definite problem of risks. And that is the margin account. Somebody buys stock of a brokerage house. And there are some Jewish brokerage houses. This is the only problem, Jewish brokerage house. So what typically they will set up is a margin account. You do not purchase the whole financial asset. But rather, you only put down usually now 50%. The rest of the money is loaned to you. So this is a regular instance of a loan, and the margin account is there is a interest that is charged on the remaining balance. And of course, if the stock will depreciate, the stock itself is the collateral to the loan. And if the stock will go down in value, so then the brokerage house will give you what is called a margin call. They will ask you to put up additional money to cover the difference, because the loan has to always be fully collateralized during its term. So at the time that you buy the stock, right now the margin is 50%. The SEC establishes that. So 50% of the price of stock I pay, the rest of it is lent to me. And the stock itself is collateral for the loan. But if the stock goes down more than 50%, then the loan becomes under collateralized, and I have to put up more money. But that's not a loan. Either I'll put up the money or they'll sell the stock. They have the right to do that. But there will be no additional loans that are made later. The whole loan is made at the initial phase when I buy the stock. So it is a regular loan where interest is paid. And just because it's called a margin agreement, that shouldn't throw us off. This is a real problem of risk. So the margin agreement, I think that you can solve the problem of this type of ISCA that we mentioned with the substitution clause, that you just the sum of money that the firm gave you, you can have to transmit to something else as the ISCA. Why? Because if you allow the ISCA to be the stock itself, then you right away run into a major problem. What would that be? If the ISCA would be the stock that you bought. Self-evident loss or gain, because the performance of the stock is a matter of public record. It's traded on the organized markets. So whatever its value is, it is established objectively. We don't need a shvua to make it, and we don't need aided to establish it, right? And audit would be wrong. Insisting upon audit would really be a wrong thing, because audit doesn't add anything. When I insist upon something, it can't possibly add anything to the level of veracity and knowledge that we have about the performance of the ISCA, then it's unethical to make such a request, right? So there's no choice. We talked about before the advisability of making a substitution. Here, there's absolutely no choice. It must be something else that is going to substitute for this guy. One of the gentlemen asked that, what happens if you have no other assets? You're right, there's right away a problem, because you cannot make this, from a practical business standpoint, it makes no sense to do this in law. And to include clauses such as shvua, it makes no sense whatsoever. In other words, here is a perfect example. If you view the ISCA as a lock, I should say, what's the problem? Well, Usher Beam will just say, I'll be head ISCA. In fact, you don't have to even write it together. The Devin, you could just say, I'll be head ISCA, but it has to make sense. And here, it makes no sense to have the ISCA and all the consequences, like to get the status posthumous that you want. It makes no sense, because what triggers the status posthumous? If the loss is not self-evident, if the gain can be ascertained, then the status could be triggered by some mechanism, either by the refusal to take the shvua or the refusal to have the audit. But if it's everything is self-evident and it's public record, there's nothing to trigger the status posthumous. So you must have something that's a substitute. And it would seem, I would suggest that it would be an idea that if the firm would really select the substitute asset. They could, that's where they could get their desired return. They would say, like, we have all the money to grow cows, they have their money market funds. They could say, well, we want you, this should be the substitute asset. That way they can get the percentage that they want. But again, this is only workable for someone who has other assets, that this substitution has to be made. All right, now, this a basic question that I'm sure you'll be asked at some point, that we're talking about, I don't want to cover everything, but I want to cover this point, that Israeli bonds, you buy Israeli bonds. What are you doing? You're lending money to the Israeli government. So how are you permitted to take interest? Now, if you want to go in there, that if you lend money to a corporation, the loaner is a limited liability, and that's the Ramoshtasal's view and the Marshak's view, then already we have an answer. But as we mentioned before, that this is not the mainstream view. It is sharply disputed. But even in this era, it's better. The lending money to the government, certainly we could conceive that as there being no violence at all, as opposed to a corporation. Corporation, Allah has to view as shuktus. Because the individuals that are the shareholders, at some point they would have a claim in the assets of the corporation. In the event of liquidation, they have a certain priority claim. There are people that preferred shareholders are before the common shareholders, and the creditors come before everybody. If you're a senior creditor or a subordinate creditor, you have preference. There's a whole line of things, but the individuals will eventually, that are shareholders, do have a residual claim in the assets of the corporation. When you talk about the government is the law, but does anyone have a residual claim in the assets of the government? The answer is clearly no. So there's no concept at all of individual violence that anyone has in the assets of the Israeli government or Israeli society in terms of the law, who the law is. Lova, there is no claim at all that anyone has in the assets of the one that's doing the borrowing. There's only a collective ownership concept, but no individual ownership concept. Like all the public lands, for example, everything that the government, the infrastructure that is built with the Israeli bonds, all the roads and the houses and everything is owned by the government. Does any individual have a claim in it at any point under any conditions? No. It is collectively owned by the state. There's only a concept of collective ownership, and there is in no shape or form a concept of individual ownership. So if we carry the svara of Rav Moshe further, so we have ready a sniff. And one thing. Yes, I'm good. The thing is, possible that others that disagree in the corporation would agree here.
Yeah.
No, but we're saying here it's qualitatively different. In terms of the law, which is the Israeli government, there is no law or rule in the sense that no one has a claim on any of anything that the law owns. The Lover is a government and its own collective. No one owns has any property right individually in it. So it's better than the case of the corporation. Yes.
What do you mean the difference? In other words, the corporation, each stockholder owns 1%, whereas the Israeli...
Each shareholder, it's true, that a shareholder cannot go into... To say General Foods, he can't go and take a box of Rice Krispies. He has no right to do that. The CEO, he has controlled disposition of assets. He could do that. But a shareholder has no right to take possession of any of the assets of the company. He only has a theoretical right in the event of liquidation, and there's a whole line of people that are making claims against the assets of the corporation. He has a certain preference, a certain priority. So, there is a concept of individual rights in the company under certain conditions. When it comes to the government, there's only concept of collective ownership. Everything the government owns, the lands and the houses, the bridges and the roads. Who owns the Brooklyn Bridge here in New York City? Does anyone have an individual right to it? It's owned by the city. People are always selling stock in the Brooklyn Bridge. And there are people that go for it also. But there is no concept of individual ownership under any conditions. It is owned by the entity of the city of New York. And the same thing you have in Israeli crime. So it's better than a corporation. We can say there is really no virus at all in terms of LOVA. So there is no LOVA. It's completely individual. It's hidden in the collective ownership. And that's not the concept of a LOVA altogether. That we could understand, even those views that dispute the revolution would agree that under those conditions, we're not really, there's no real LOVA that exists. Yes.
So the corporation is the issue, the disposition of the assets or the control of the assets?
Well, as I mentioned before, that the Achron Vadaf is two prime criteria of what's a Jewish corporation. If the majority of the shareholders are Jewish, it's considered to be a Jewish company. Even if it's not the case, if the manager, and of course, I would adopt the most lenient concept of that, and that is the CEO. If he is Jewish, then there's a problem. Anybody under him doesn't really have authority, but subject to the veto of the CEO.
He may control the disposition of that.
Yes. Doesn't matter. But that makes it ready a Jewish company. Like Thomas Katzoff and Rivas, it's considered to be a Jewish borrower. Because the person that will make the decisions is, you are Jewish owners, right? But even though they're not the majority, but still there is a Jew that controls the disposition of the assets. So that really makes it a LOVA, Jewish LOVA. You cannot consider these Jewish owners as insignificant, as Buck Wolf, because the fact is it is a Jewish owner, a Jewish manager. Well, that's why I only want to go. I would say that interpreting this view, I would say that you have a whole hierarchy and structure through. You go to the CEO, because he is really the one that can veto anything. Any decision that's made by a lower level manager is subject to reverse. So therefore, he doesn't really have control. That's taking a very lenient view of things, but at the very least, we'd have to agree that if the CEO is Jewish, then there is a Jew is determining the disposition of the assets.
You mean Jewish plus one stockholders? I mean, you mean with our let's say you have 20 women
the Jewish manager is then it's mamish the case of the Shulchan Aruch mentioned before. Somebody gives money. Again, it's not Malka. These people are owners of the, so the business can't be run. And are you saying the case with the manager is Jewish?
Yeah, I'm having the same problem. Yeah, but how does the manager hold the sheep is on the property and on the
sheep? All right, so there has to be some Jewish owners, right? If there's all God are the owners, only God is a Jewish manager, it's not a Jewish company. If there are some Jewish owners and there is a Jewish manager, that's when you have problems. But then you can't say it's not a Jewish company because there is a Jew that is determining the disposition of the assets. Alright, now so another conceptualization of the Israeli bonds, why it's not a question of rivers, is that it's not really a you're not really lending the money. It's just what it's for. It's just for convenience sake, we're calling it the person who buys it a lender. But really what we have is a partnership. Rabban Ziel, Chaim Ziel, one of the first chief rabbis that Eretz Yisrael, that's what he said, and many people took up that really what's involved is in the Israeli bonds, it's just simply a mechanism to create a partnership between people that want to have a chelek in Yishev Haaretz and building up land and Kibbutz Goliyos. So this is really a shutvus, what we have here. Partnership. That a person who is, there are people that are contributing their capital. And they are content to have only a certain percentage return. So they're not a malvin, but rather a sugar. So the question is to draw it out, that what kind of relationship is being set up here when the person is lent, he's not really lent, he's getting interest on the bottom, but we don't really regard him as a lent, but rather as a person who wants to be a shutter in the building of Eretz Yisrael, in the infrastructure of Eretz Yisrael. That's really what he is. He is a shutter. But the question is he a silent partner? We began the whole discussion today. Iska is a financier and he's an active partner, right? So the person that is purchasing the Israeli bond, we should not view him as a lender. We should view him as a shutter. Someone that is a silent partner making available capital. So how should we view him, though, what's the self-image of the person that's wanting? Does he view himself as a silent partner, or is he an active partner? What's the difference? Whether you take part in decision-making. See, and then it seems that there would be a slight problem, wouldn't there be, if we would view the people that buy bonds as being silent partners, right? Because then becomes ready an ISPA, and we have to regulate it in accordance with the rules of ISPA. It can only be symmetrical division of profits and losses, which is no problem at all, because he's only taking a small percentage, right? And there is no problem there. But what about Skatirka? Where's the Skatirka? That seems to be a missing element, right? So we're seeing all these people that are making the big point to interfere with the internal affairs of Eretz Yisrael, the Yehudi people, a lot of these people that bought the Israeli bonds, they want to be machmir on themselves. They want to view themselves as not a sovereign partner, which would be bring them a shayla of this question of Sartir, but they didn't provide that to the Misaskim, so they have to say Deya. You must say a Deya in every respect to give their views in every single matter. But even those people that are kind enough and not to do that because they refrain from interfering with the internal affairs. They regard themselves as simply a sovereign partner and they have a chelik in the mitzvah. Who it seems to me that there's no need for the Skaratirva because we're really dealing with violent shame and nidur. We really can't identify immediately the people that would be responsible for paying the interest. It is not something that we could identify Meroch, because first of all, government has always the option of financing the bond, the interest. The only problem is the interest portion of the bond, not the principal, the interest portion. There's always the rarer to fiat money. The government goes, prints up money and pay losses, which will involve no taxes, no tax burden anyone. So there's no lower, and there's this possibility. So we really can't identify any of the people that are the so-called borrowers beginning, because we could conceptualize everyone really as basically being an artist, not a borrower. Because the government always has the option of printing up money and paying off the interest, or rolling over the bonds by selling new ones to people. That's another maneuver that minimizes the need to tax people. If you have an active market, you can roll up people, roll over debt. If you have interest is new, so you sell new bonds, and the principal of the new bonds is really what finances the interest payments of the old bonds. So you're not really taxing anyone to pay the bonds. So the loafer is only in the sense of, we can't view the Israeli economy as people in Israel as being set up this mechanism as being borrowers. They're really just outraging. They're guaranteeing it that in the last resort they would be taxed a day. But so they're only outraging, and we can't really identify who exactly is the artist. So we see that there's no need to have the stock here. But essentially, it would be better to have, I think, not to have in mind to be an active partner, especially in perspective, if you want to be helping,
government,
no? So, they're well paid. Well, going back to another part, that really there's no loan. It is just a collective ownership. There's no identifiable loan on any level.
Well, then it's like you don't need it at all,
right? The other thing, it's a different idea. There is no loan. There's no mild loan. There's a shortness. So, if there's a shortness, the question is, what kind of shortness is it? People provide the capital. Are they stronger partners, or are they active partners? The only type of business transaction that's regulated by Chazal is the ISCO, when you have a stronger and an active partner. But if the people are active, that's what they said, they're unless these people that are the Yehudi issues, like they want to be active partners. So then they remove the Shaila, the Star Tirka element.
No, I think it's between some of the partners are, if you're saying that you should partner between the advisory bond and those who are citizens, right? That's the idea. Assuming you call it a partnership, not the partner idea. Now, some of those citizens run the country, be the prime minister or the Knesset and so on.
Oh, you have people that wear two hats. It's still the same problem. There are people, of course, a lot of the Israeli bonds are born by their natives. And so they're wearing two hats here at the same time, but that's still a problem, though. That doesn't remove the problem. The fact that they're both borrowers and lenders, if there is a net interest that they're paying, then there is a problem.
So I don't mean interest. I'm sorry, you say, let's consider this a shortlist. Now we have a problem that the active partner should be paid as far as your bond. So why don't you? Now, who's
right.
The shortness between those who buy the bond and those who...
Okay, the shortness is between those and the Misaskim. So you have a whole large group that are Misaskim, and they are also the so that's what I'm saying. The Misaskim are really not identifiable. The people that make the decisions and the people that are occupied in the management of the ISCO.
Aren't there people in the Israeli government who run the show? And why aren't they not the violators? Why isn't their salary considered as a pay?
Because you can't link any particular project with any particular person. So I mean that makes them really you can't really say that any particular person is managing the enterprise in order to get the law. Well, we explained the rationale before. What is the Sadir before? Because if you would not be a Sadir, so then people would be working for nothing in order to get the law, right? But as we said before, they would not have to pay anything anyway for it because it's just an element of a raven, because the government could always print up money or refinance the bonds with new bonds rolling off. So you can't say that they're working for nothing in order to get involved. That whole concept is you can't say. Because of the fact that you're dealing with government, how they could finance it.
Yeah, lots of stuff. Okay. And then finish everything up. And then we get it once they have it, right?